Daf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph, and we're about to start the Mishnah, which is about two-thirds down the Amud. But first, I want to just give a little bit of an overview, just as a review of what we did. So as we start a new sugya, we'll remember the old sugya. And we were talking about what we said was second-rate or fallback mechitzos, like a shasi or an erev, and we could rely on them in the case of a shayor, in the case of a caravan. And we had various opinions about whether the caravan relying on these second-rate mechitzos is made up of three people, made up of one person. Also, we had a discussion about the area that it encompasses. And we basically allowed per person an area of what's called two base saw. And we had the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda. He held that if the area has a base saw and there's only one individual, will allow relying on these second-rate mechitzos so that he can carry within those mechitzos up to two base saw. If he has two people, will allow them four base saw. Okay? And that's according to Rabbi Yehuda. Now, once we get to the level of a shayara, and we have three people, so then we may allow for a larger area and rely on these mechitzas for a larger area. And according to one school of thought, once we get to the level of a shayara and we have three people, there are chachamim that would allow as much space as they need. Now, when we talk about space, it means for their kelim, it means for their animals, and so forth and so on. Whatever they need, the sky's the limit, because they already hit that, you know, that bingo, they're a shayora, they're three people in this caravan. Then we have a shita Rab Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and he says that even if you have a shayora, we're only going to allow 2 times 3 for a shayor that's comprised of 3 people. 2 base saw times 3, which means up to but not beyond 6 base saw. There was another shita that said we'll give him 1 extra base saw as a chupar, as a gift. And again, there's one shita that would say that even in the case where you don't have a shayara, you have only one individual or two individuals, we're going to rely on these mechitzos. They can set up shop, and they could be metaltel with a shasi or an erev, and there are no restrictions whatsoever. All right, this leads us to the Mishnah that hopefully will kick off a new and good week. My goal is to finish the perek in about a day's time. I don't think we'll finish it today, but maybe later on in the week, and then we could start the second parag. And Arba Dvarim Patru B'machne. Now, it's interesting. This Mishnah is kind of a digression from Masechta Erevin, in the sense that once we've been discussing what's called the Shayara, then we're going to ask another question. What's the deal with a different kind of shayara? Not a shayara of business people that are going traveling from with their wares and their goods from one town to the next, and they're going through an open area. We're going to talk about an army camp, a machne of chayalim. And the Mishnah is going to enumerate 4 leniencies in which the halacha bends overboard for the sake of the chayalim. Number 1, Mevi'im Eitzim Mikol Makom. Now, this is unbelievable. The Chayalim in their encampment, they need wood. They need wood perhaps for building purpose, but more likely for fuel to keep a fire going. They're allowed to abscond with anybody's wood. My private property, they can take it away. Governmental orders. Of course, the Gemara is going to limit this. We'll see all the restrictions. But just to get the general concept, there's no private ownership here. And as far as the Chayalim, whatever they need to take in wood, they're allowed to take. And number 2, Pturim Mirchitzas Yodayim. They don't have to wash their hands. within the context of a meal. Now, you and I know there are two different mechitzas yadayim. There's one before the meal, and then there's one after the meal. Before the meal is a separate mitzvah. It's a takon of Shlomo Melch way back in the time because of Srach Truma, that yadayim shneils the Tuma, and it might be Mitami Truma. In the case of Mayim Achronim after the Suda, that's a health issue. So we're not sure in which context is the Mishnah allowing leniency for the soldiers. So that's going to be the Sugya Sagamora. Number three, meet Dmai, right? So Dmai is food that you buy in the market, and it's grains and fruits. So you don't know if these grapes were Meisered or not. Did the seller take off Meiser? The seller is called an Amoritz. He has no, you know, he doesn't have any credentials. We've never seen him to be a super pious person. And Chazal made a takana called Dmai. Dmai means what's inside of it. We don't know what's in it. That's Dmai, what's in it. We're not sure if the seller took off Maser or not. So in such a case, the Rabbanah required that you take off Maser, just to be on the safe side. However, although you and I are not allowed to eat from this Dmai until we take off Maser, in the case of a Chayal, and he's part of a camp, and they purchase a massive, you know, supply of food from an Amoris, from someone who doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have a Tudat Hechsher. So in such a case, we normally would have to be Mafish Maser, but the Chayalim don't have to be Mafish Maser. That's the third leniency for the sake of, and the benefit of, the Chayalim. And number four, Umila Arev. They don't need an Erev. So they're allowed to carry without an Erev. What Erev are we talking about? I don't know. And that's what the Sugya Sagamara is going to try to analyze. Basically, the Gemara assumes two possibilities and analyzes both. One is called an Erev Chatzeros, and the other is called an Erev Tchumen. An Erev Chatzeros is required whenever you have a group of people in a closed area that spills into a Rishus HaRav. And an Erev Tchumen means to allow you to go beyond 2,000 Amma, beyond the city limits. So one of those two is going to be waived, W-A-I-V-E, on behalf of the Chayalim. Okay, let's begin the Gemara. Tana Rabbana, we learned in a Braisa, Machne Hayotze Slimel Chames HaRishus. Now, we have two types of battles, of military campaigns. We have what's called the Melchemes Mitzvah, which basically breaks down to conquering the land of Israel, the seven nations that occupied the land. Number two, if Chas V'Shalom were attacked by an enemy, and now we have to defend ourselves, that's also Melchemes Mitzvah. Number three is Amalek. If Amalek comes to attack us, or maybe even if we take the initiative, that's called a Melchemes Mitzvah. Now, there's another category of Melchama. And that's a discretionary war. That means that the king of Israel decides that we want to expand the bounds of Israel, and therefore we want to conquer lands above, below. And David HaMelech actually did that in a place called Aram Tzova, which is north of the bounds of Eretz Yisrael, around Syria. And a Melchemes Rishus means that there really is no obligation to fight that battle. Yet the Brisa says, if we are going out to battle, the king has made that decision. Again, he has to get the approval of the High Court of Israel. Is mutarim begezel eitzim yevashim. So again, if we're finding a leniency on behalf of the Chayalim who are out to battle in a discretionary war, how much more so? It goes without saying, as we use the phrase in Yiddish, it's upgeret. I don't even have to tell you that in a Melchemes Mitzvah, for sure this is going to be mutter. But the Brice is telling you that even in a Melchemes Rishus, which is not obligatory, nevertheless, we're going to allow the Chayalim to take and abscond with somebody else's wood. But what is the nature of the wood? Take a look. The Brisa says, Yevashim. These are dried logs of wood. Now, why is this the limitation here in the Heter? Okay. So once again, we're going to apply the principle of upgareth. Meaning, this doesn't mean as we said, that this is a limitation. They can only take dry wood for the chayalim. No. Even dry wood. Dry wood means, if you cut down a tree, you know, ask the Boy Scouts, I think they'll agree with me, that tree is not really ready to be thrown into a campfire as fuel. It's still moist. You know, put your hand against the tree, you'll feel the moisture. There's a process by which we dry the wood. And after we dry the wood, then it's functional as fuel. This Bryce is telling me that even if you find dry wood, which means that the owner obviously spent his efforts to dry the wood, he has designated for fuel, nevertheless, even in that case, the chayalim are allowed to take away the wood and they don't violate the Isur Gzela. Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema Omer, Af Chonin B'chol Mokom. Number two, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseris says that they could set up their camp anywhere. So for example, if we're talking about wood, then we're talking about my ownership of the wood. And certainly if you're taking my wood and I put so much effort to dry the wood, that would be gzeila under normal situations. And the Chachamim are making an enactment in which they are alleviating, removing private possession, there's no gzeila. Now there's another case of gzeila, of private possession, and that is the case of karka. For example, there's no such thing as squatter's rights in halacha. You can't just come into my karka and decide I'm camping here overnight, you know, bindu, just because you decide that you want to get cheap labor, you know, instead of paying for a hotel, you're going to hang out, you know, camp out in my backyard. That's gzela. But not in the case of chayalim, even if it's only a milchemes rishus. Again, we are removing private ownership, private property in the case of karka. And that's where Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseris says they can just find a good field where they want to encamp, and that's where they'll encamp. I was once down in Virginia for a long period of, you know, not a long period of time, but I mean a few days. I was a scholar in residence, but my wife and I spent a day or two beyond the Shabbos. And they took us to see a lot of places where the Confederates, you know, had set up their camps. You know, sometimes they would go into the backyard of someone and the Confederates would, and this was true for the North as well. You know. So next time you want to learn about the Civil War, I'll give you two choices. Either you go down to Virginia or just read today's newspapers. That's good enough. Anyway. Then, Ubimakom Shenergu Sham Nikbarim. And this is an interesting halacha, which I hope we're going to figure it out. Normally, we bury a person in a cemetery. That's a designated area for the dead. But if Sama Nebuch is killed in battle, then we bury him on the spot. And it doesn't matter if it's private property or whatever it is. That's where he's going to be buried. What's it all about? Now the Gemara goes through each one of these rulings of the Braisa one by one. Number one, Mutarim Begezel Eitzim Yaveshim. So the Gemara says, why is it that we need our Mishnah for this? And the Braisa opens up by saying that Machne Hayotzeis Milchama, etc., etc., in this case Milchamas Rishus, is they are permitted to take the dry wood. As if to say that this is some sort of new enactment. Well, in truth, this goes back to the very beginning of Eretz Yisrael as a Jewish settlement. Haitakanta di Yoshua Havi. When Yoshua crossed the Jordan River on his way to lead a military campaign to take over the land, he enacted 10 different things. We're not going to go through all 10 of them. That's a sugya in Bava Basra, but we are going to focus on one or two of them. What was his enactment? Shiyu marin b'choroshim u'melaktim etzim mistoseihem. So I'm going to go backwards and start with the second enactment of Yoshua, and then we'll go back to the first. Because the second one is more relevant to our discussion. Melaktim, Eitzim, mistoseihem. We're not talking about some sort of Melchemes Rishus, like we said at the time of David HaMelech, he conquered the north. We're talking about the original Melchama of Yoshua. And Yoshua says, there's no such thing as private property here. When the Chayalim are encamping within the context of this military campaign, then they could take wood from wherever they want to. Now, the Brisa seems to assume that this leniency is limited to a machne chayalim, to the army camp, and it applies to machne shalayotzim l'mulchama. However, that's not the impression you get from this Gemara of the Takanos of Yoshua. The Takanos of Yeshua have to do with the way we divide up the land. And Yoshua instituted a division of the land that had in it certain built-in limitations on private property. One of them, as far as wood is concerned. Now again, it's not clear exactly how wide is the scope of Yoshua's enactment. Okay, we'll have to, in Ritz Hashem, analyze that. He says that Malaktim Eitzim Mistoseihem. And the beer says, "Rashoi kol adam lelaket etzim mitoch sadosav shel chaveru, v'ein balas sada yochol li'akev olav." In other words, Yoshua divided up the land, and he said, "Look, I'm going to give you this land, the division of the land. You inherit this parcel of land, but you should know your ownership over the land is limited." He wanted to facilitate a kind of a socialism, if you want to call it, to allow every Jew, no matter where he is, to collect these pieces of wood. Because again, you know, what happens if Reuven gets stuck with a piece of land and there are no trees there? You know, wood is something that is almost a basic necessity. So that kind of is hefker. You know, that's according to Yoshua's enactment. Again, we have to understand, it doesn't mean I'm allowed to steal your wood. It means that within the context of the original division of land, there was a limitation in your private property, your private ownership, in which Yoshua said, Ad Kan, you can own the land, and these are the conditions in which you can own the land. But don't insist that if there's wood to be had on the land, that it's your wood and no one else could take it from you. And Yoshua was not addressing the Machne Melchama. He wasn't limiting himself to the chayalim. Im ken yesh l'tmoa, this is the Gemara's kashim, adua hutzruchu chachamim. Why did the chacham feel at some point in time the need for enacting a takana? On behalf of the anshei atzava, the chayalim, shir rashoim litol eitzim istosem shalachir arei kol adam uptukach. From the perspective of Yoshua, he was guaranteeing that every Jew inheriting the land, no matter where he was from, what shevet, and whether he wasn't a chayal, on duty or not on duty, he would have access to the trees, to the wood. This is not specific for and limited to the chayalim. Let's go back to the original first takana, Mereim Bechoroshin. Now, some people would inherit the land that had a lot of pasture area. Choroshim, like a forest, you know, that has lots of greenery that's growing. And many Jews had sheep and cattle and so forth, and they needed graze area, and they didn't have graze area. So Yoshua instituted that if you own a forest in your parcel of land, you have to allow anybody who has an animal and needs to find grazing area to allow them to graze from your forest. And you have no right to block him from doing so. Now, it seems to me that the first of the two takanos has a certain advantage, at least conceptually, it's a little bit easier to appreciate than the second one. Second one is, in my opinion, and I want to discuss this with you, is a more radical chidush that has to be understood of Yoshua. The first one I understand. I own a yar. I own a forest. It's got lots of grazing area. And presumably there's enough for everybody. I don't need all that, you know, this gigantic forest in order to feed my sheep. So, although in a pure capitalistic society, if I own this forest, I have a right to say, you're trespassing, you have no right to go into my forest, Yoshua enacted a limitation on my rights to exercise private ownership, and I have to say, you know what, let others live as well. They also need this grazing area. So that I understand. What I'm trying to drive at is that the owner of the forest really doesn't lose anything. There's no what we call hefsed mamon. And therefore, it would make sense to have this leniency to allow an animal to go into a forest and graze from the forest growth, the produce, whatever it is. There's no loss to the owner. But in the second case, that's really far out. You know, then you're talking about etzim, you're talking about wood. And it's my private wood. I could use it. You're taking my wood. I suffer a loss. Not only that, wood is something that's very easily marketable. So I'm not sure exactly, until we see the next line in the Gemara, how far-reaching is this second takana. But let's get back on board. So the Gemara is asking, why does our mission in the Braisa institute an enactment on behalf of the Chayalim, when way back when Yoshua already instituted this enactment on behalf of all of Klal Yisrael? So my answer is, Hasam, even Yoshua was not allowing laissez-faire. You know, this wasn't just pure socialism. Anyone could come in and take away my trees, my wood. But rather, v'hizmi v'hige, or mine kotzim, they're different types of thistles and thorns, very small bushes, that grow from the ground. And that's what Yoshua and his original takana permitted, that you could go into someone else's field and take away his hizmi and higi. And this quiets me down on my original problem, because I thought, what's going on over here? How could an owner of land suffer such a tremendous financial loss that his trees are taking away? So Gemara says, no. When it says, malaktim eitzim misdoseim, it doesn't say malaktim eitzim mi charsheim, because charsheim would be a place where you grow trees. That's called a forest. So again, I don't know if you and I, or Merriam-Webster in the dictionary, you look up the word forest and it'll say, that's where trees grow. I think it would, but I'm not sure. But in any event, that's where trees grow, in a yar. And that's called charshin in the language of the Mishnah. That's not what Yoshua permitted. I can't come in to your forest and cut down your trees. That would cause you a hefsed. What I can do is, I can take away your hizmi and higi in the context of Yeshua's takana, because you don't take a loss. That's not what you're going to use for fuel. But you have someone who's pretty, you know, pretty desperate, and he needs any kind of wood that he can get. He'll take even these thorns and these small low bushes. Hacha. But now we have another takana for the sake of the machde tzava, for the chayalim. And that goes way, way beyond, is Bashar Eitzim. They're allowed to take over any trees, any wood, whatever they need in the context of their machne tzava. So that's the Gemara's first answer to justify why we needed a separate takana of machna yotzis lemulcham. Second answer. Inami hasam, in the case of takanas Yoshua b'mechubarim, Hacha b'tlushim. According to the second answer, when Yoshua made this enactment, he only allowed it before the owner of the field, or the owner of the forest, more, cut down the trees. The owner of the forest has not put in any effort whatsoever. The trees are growing naturally. And therefore, we've severely limited the hefsed, the loss. But in the case of the army, is Hacha B'Tlushim. We made a special enactment allowing the soldiers to take away that which was cut down. And that means that the owner of the tree actually went through the entire effort of designating these logs for his fuel. And despite that fact, we're going to allow. Basically, I think you could say it this way. As far as Yoshua's heter is concerned, his heter is not on an outright gzela. It's more like on a potential gzela or a half-baked gzela. Notice it's true that without Yoshua we need this enactment, because technically the fellow owns the Hizmi and Higgy. He owns trees even if they're growing naturally and he hasn't yet cut them down. But it's not a full-fledged gzela. Why? Because in the context of selling the land, there's got to be a certain understanding of the way we're going to allow for ownership, accessibility, private ownership, and common ownership, so to speak. I called it like a kind of socialism, in order to facilitate ish tachas te'eno, you know, that every Jew should have a comfortable settlement in Eretz Yisrael. That was Yoshua's purpose. But it's not outright gzela. Now we have a new takana for the chayalim. And that means they're allowed to take something that would be outright gzela. Imagine, not only do I have trees growing in my forest, I cut them down. And I want to market them, or I want to use them as fuel, which is worth something. And now you're coming and taking it away for the benefit of the chayalim. That's a whole new takana. Then it goes as far as removing gzela is concerned. Now, the Torah says, lo tigzol, you're not allowed to steal. By what authority do the Chachamim have rights to lift the Isur Gzela? And the answer is something called Hefker Bezdin Hefker. Again, if I have a whiteboard, I would write it on the board. If you want, I'll spell it for you. But anyway, Hefker Bezdin Hefker means that the court system, the judiciary, has the right to take away and remove private ownership. A tremendous authority that the Gemara derives from Psukim. Gemara in Yevamos derives from Psukim. I forgot what it's called in Latin. Anybody remember? If you could look it up for me, if you have a second. You know, that the government has rights to take away private ownership. Inami, a third... What's it called? Appropriation. No. There's something in Latin. You know, something like habeas corpus, but not that. I mean, I forgot what it's called. Anyway, Hasam, ver belachim. When Yoshua made his takana, these eitzim, these pieces of wood, were not ready for fuel. It has to be processed. Right now they're moist. You've just cut down the tree. That's it. Hacha, but here, in the case of the enactment, for the benefit of the chayalim, even though it's yevashim, these trees, these logs, have undergone an entire process to dry them. I mean, the many Gemaras where they describe how they dry them, cut them down to certain sizes, put up the roof, you know, the sun would come, and this, that, and the other thing. Today we have maybe more sophisticated ways with technology and machines to dry things, you know, wood that's wet. But in any event, it was a big hassle. And now, once again, there's private ownership. After all, I went through the whole hassle with my trees, and I made them into logs. I dried them, they're ready for fuel. No. They're allowed, the chayalim are allowed to have access to. So again, as far as Takonis Ezra, Takonis Yoshua is concerned, it's limited to certain kind of kotzim, you know, these thorn bushes that are connected to the karka. They haven't been cut down. And if they have been cut down, they're still moist. But as far as the battlefield is concerned, the Chachamim went a step further, major step further. They were matir, taking away all sorts of trees, not just these thorn bushes, and even after they've been detached from the ground and they've been dried. Okay. Now it's interesting. I always often think, what are the Chayalim doing with these, with this wood? And I thought that maybe they need the wood to build, you know, some temporary structure as they're encamping. But the Rishonim seem not like that. They need the wood to fuel the pots, you know, they have to make themselves food, and they had a little bit of a kitchen on the, you know, out in the camp, and they needed wood desperately in order to get their flames going up so that they could, you know, they could make food for the chayalim. Now Rabbi Yudim ben Tema says, So that's okay. They can encamp anywhere, but b'makom shenerogim sham nikbarim. Now, the Gemara is going to analyze this from a perspective of a very well-known principle. We'll soon see where this principle is codified, called mes mitzvah. Have you ever heard of it? Mes mitzvah. Mes mitzvah means when you find a body, a corpse, Nebuch, out in the highway, out in the, you know, in the fields. In such a case, we don't bury the dead in a cemetery. Now again, things have changed in our time, but I just want you to get the abstract halacha. So that's called a mes mitzvah. And the Gemara in many places talks about the greatness of that mitzvah to bury the dead. For example, you're on your way to slaughter the Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan, you encounter a mes mitzvah, forget about the Korban Pesach. You ain't going to bring the Korban Pesach. We'll give you a second chance in a month, but not today. Because you got to bury the dead. And the Gemara once described the situation where a person found a mes mitzvah, he found this corpse, and he dragged the corpse in order to bury it in a cemetery. And the Gemara says that he's chayav for every four amos, that he, because a mes mitzvah is koneh makomo. He actually acquires that piece of property, you know, of real estate for burial purposes. Now, one of the things we're going to discuss is what happens if you find a corpse laying across Rosh Hashanah, across a public highway. We're going to bury him on the highway? And that's not covered a mess. You know, people are, you know, traveling with all their caravans and their wagons, and they're going to go. So then we're going to see how he should go either to the right or to the left and bury the dead. But in any event, this is a well-known principle, which is called mes mitzvah. And we don't need a special enactment at the face of it. On behalf of the chayalim, if a chayal Nebuch dies out there in the battlefield, he is a classic mes mitzvah. There's a special mitzvah to bury him. So the Gemara says, Pshita, why did the Brisa seem to indicate in the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema that there was a special enactment to bury a chayal in the place where he died? Mes mitzvah. And mes mitzvah kono makomo. Wherever he is, that's his place. No one can take it from him. That's where we're going to bury him. And, you know, Yoshua was the originator of this takona of mes mitzvah kono makomo. When the people crossed the Jordan again to fight the battle against the seven nations, you know, Yoshua realized that there are going to be losses in any military campaign. And he made a takana that if a chayal dies, he's kona makomo. But again, he didn't formulate it in terms of chayalim. He wanted to make this a takana for all of Klal Yisrael. That in any situation, whether it's in the military or out, if a person dies, he's kona makomo. And that's where we're going to bury him. So that therefore, if this is one of the 10 takanos of Yoshua when he entered into the land, also part of, let's say, socialism in the sense that I can't object, this is my private property, get this corpse out of here, I don't want to bury him in my property. Oh no, I don't have rights to do that. So on behalf of all of Klal Yisrael, he enacted a takana called Mes Mitzvah Kona Mekoma. Why do you say that in the case of a soldier, you have a special enactment that he should be buried as a Mes Mitzvah? Lo Tzricha Afal Gav. Here we're going to turn to Daf Yud Zayin Amid Beis. The Islay Kovrin. There are plenty of people who would offer to bury this soldier, Nebuch, back in the cemetery. For example, let's say he has relatives, close relatives. So the first responders, so to speak, in terms of burial, according to the halacha, are the relatives. Right, there are 7 close relatives, and they would have to sit shiva, they would have to fulfill their obligation of mourning and grief over the dead because of their status as relatives. And within the greater concept or context of mourning and grief, there's a chiyuv kvura, and you have to bury your relative. That's your obligation. So let's say, for example, a chayal, Nebuch dies, and he has relatives. He has a yorshim, let's say, for example. I mean, that's just one example. You and I would have said, that's not called a mes mitzvah. That's not included in the Yoshua's takana mes mitzvah koma koma. Mes mitzvah koma koma means that there's no one around who's obligated to bury him. Now again, when I say around, I don't know what that proximity is. But let's assume that, you know, we want to bury the dead as soon as we can. So he may have a relative, he's down in, he dies in a lot, you know, and he's got a relative up in Metula, and you know, it's going to take a day or two, you know, for the camels, you know, to get from Eilat to Metula, from Dan to Beersheba. So we're not going to wait for that. That's called a mes mitzvah. Or, for example, a ger, a convert, or let's say a person who lost his parents, he's not married, he doesn't have any children. There are many cases where a person is a mes mitzvah and lo kovrim. He doesn't have anyone to bury him. But here, we're talking about a case, the Islay Kovrin, where despite the fact that he may have been a young man, never who was killed in battle, he does have relatives who are obligated in Kvura. And here there's a special enactment that we will bury him in the place that he died. Again, we'll see the exceptions to the rule. And we're not going to wait for his relatives to come. We're in a battle now. We're not going to leave the dead, you know, lying there on the thing. Here in Israel, we have Zaka, we have also a special unit of Chayalim, like the Chovshim, and others who are in charge of all this kind of stuff. And during wartime, they put their lives into danger sometimes, just to go out there and okay, again, today we bury a dead in a cemetery. But I'm just pointing out that there's a tremendous halachic significance, and Tzahal recognizes this, in burying a chayal that Nebuchadnezzar was killed at battle. I mean, this is what we're fighting with those Yimach Shemo Hamasniks, you know, to give us the remains of, let's say, maybe two chayalim that they're holding on to. The Sanya, we learned in a braisa, Ezu mes mitzvah. How do you define a mes mitzvah? Which means that A, we bury him where he's found, wherever the corpse is. B, we said that if you're on your way to the Korban Pesach and you're going to become Tomei by burying the dead, you still have to bury the dead. Or C, what am I forgetting, the most basic halach? A Kohen is not allowed to defile himself except for the seven close relatives. But in the case of a mes mitzvah, a Kohen has to defile himself. He has to bury the dead. Despite his chilul kedushas kuna, he desecrates his sanctity. Why? Because that's the halacha of a mes mitzvah. But the braisa defines a mes mitzvah kol she'ein lo kovrim. There's no one around to bury him. If there's other people around, for example, the kohen doesn't have to bury this mes mitzvah. If there's someone else who's not a kohen who could bury the mes mitzvah. Now, how do we define others who are in close proximity, and therefore it's not a mes mitzvah because they can, you know, they can take a short train ride or a bus ride and bury the dead. No. No bus rides and no train rides. It's kore ve'achirim onimoso, which literally means that there are Jews right there. In Yiddish we call it afen art, in the spot. You just yell out and they hear you. Hey, there's a mes mitzvah here. But if, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said mes mitzvah, I should have said that you yell out, here's a dead body. That body is not a mes mitzvah. Ein zeh mes mitzvah. If there are people who hear your voice when you call out, then a kohen would not be allowed to be metame, let someone else be metame. So in other words, there are Jews who could bury the dead, then that's not mes mitzvah. And these Jews are in close proximity. And perhaps we'll get a chance to read a note on this Gemara, but just to get the flow of the Gemara, we're going to learn, derive from this Braisa, that as far as a Kohen contracting Tumah for the benefit, for the sake of burying the dead, we don't consider a mes mitzvah someone where there are other Jews other than a Kohen who are not Kohenim who could bury the dead. And also, if there are other people who could bury the dead, then he's not Kones Makomo. He doesn't, so to speak, have rights to be buried in that place. And that's as far as Takonas Yoshua is concerned, of a mes mitzvah. But when we get to the case of a chayal who was killed, even if he's not technically a base mitzvah, you can call people and they'll come, he still has the status of a mes mitzvah, and he's Kodem Makomo, and we'll bury him right there. What happens if he dies on a highway? That's where his dead body is. So the Gemara says, the mes mitzvah kana makomo, that's not really true. For Tanya, we have a brisa, motzi mes muto bistratia. Bistratia is a highway, so public thoroughfare, and you find the dead body strewn across a public thoroughfare, is mefaneu. We have to take him away from the highway in order to bury him. First, liyamin hasratya, take him to the right side of the highway. Or, alternatively, there's a little more space to the left side, small of hasratya. And both are options. So in other words, we see clearly from this brisa that there are situations in which a mes mitzvah is not kona makoma. He doesn't have absolute rights to be buried at a certain spot. Here, again, we know the answer to the Gemara's question already, you know, because I already hinted at it, you know, that this is all for the sake of the dead. You know, the last place in the world you want to be buried on is on a sratya. So we'll get to that in a minute. Now the brisa continues. Stay boor. Now, stay boor is a field that has been plowed. It's been plowed, and they leave it open. In other words, the plow creates these furrows, opening up the ground, and they wait for who knows how long till the rains seep in. They may even skip a couple of seasons until they actually plant, because the ground is now regaining its nutrients. And it's stronger now. So that's called the stay near. Stay near means you've done the harvest, the plowing, but there's no seeding. Then we have something called, so that's a stay near. Wait a minute, I skipped something. And then we have a stay boor. And then we have something called a stay zera. So let's talk about a stay zera. Stay zera would be a field where you've already planted. And in all these cases, like stay near and stay zera, mefaneu, we will not bury the dead there. Now, what's a stay boor? So let me read to you what he says is a stay boor. He says, ba'ofen shumemait benezek ha-nigram lebal ha-sodom im hoya betzad ha-echod. So he says the following, that a stay boor is worth something, and that's not where you want to bury the dead, because you're really causing him a loss. So wait, let me just read to you stay boor. He says a fallow field. Just 1 second. Oh, I see. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. What he's saying here is that if you have a choice between burying a person in a stay boor or a stay near, mefaneu l'stay boor, what does that mean? That if the plowing is already done in a field, you know, that's a pretty expensive workload, you know, maybe you paid your workers to plow the field. Now you have another choice. There's an unplowed field. Nothing's growing there. So you have two choices. Then in order to limit the loss, the financial loss of the owner of the stay, of the stay near, because again all that effort has been made to already plow the field, then we'll move the corpse into what's called a stay boor, which is a regular field that has not been plowed. Now you have another choice. What happens if your two choices are a stay near and a stay zera? So one field has been plowed but hasn't been planted. The other field has been plowed and planted. So in such a case, Mifaneu will move the corpse over to the stay near because you're cutting your losses, right? If your two options are equal, they're two fallow fields or two sown fields that have already been seeded, you have two fields that are they've already been plowed, then we'll choose the place that we want and we'll bury the dead there. But again, just to summarize, for our purposes, what we see clearly in this brisa is that there are many scenarios in which we will actually move the corpse to bury it somewhere else, and that's called mifaneu. And we're not going to apply the principle of mes mitzvah kone mekomo. So how do we reconcile this brisa with the principle of mes mitzvah? The case in the brisa is that the corpse is lying across the width of the road between two boundaries. So you have a boundary here and a boundary there, and there's a road in between, and he's lying across the width of the road. So if you'd ask me, I think what the Gemara has in mind here is that this would not be a covered ames. This would not be the appropriate place to bury the dead. Imagine you wanted to visit that kever. You'd have to stop traffic. I don't know if you can get permission to do so. And therefore, mifaneu l'chol ruach sheyirtze. And that's when we will move the corpse and rebury it either here or there, depending upon, you know, the various options. And that's called mitoshen nitna reshus lefanoso mina meitzar is mifanei lechol ruach sheyirtze. So again, let's just summarize. The rights of the corpse to be buried in that place where it's located fall into three categories. One category is going to be a classic mes mitzvah, which means A, there's no one within earshot who will bury this dead. B, he's kone makomo. But C, it's at no great loss to anybody. But he's kone makomo, and the corpse has rights to be buried right there. That's a mes mitzvah. No one's around right now to bury him. You're the only person around. You can bury him exactly where he died. Then we go down one notch. And that's a case of a mes mitzvah. No one's around to bury you. But you have two options. And you could reduce the damage by simply moving the corpse away from a place where there'll be damage, or alternatively, away from a public highway. And finally, we get to the case of the chayalim. And the chayalim have the status of kones makomo, as if it were a mes mitzvah, this despite the fact that there may be relatives in close proximity who can hear your call and come to bury the dead. And that's the takana that we're learning about now on behalf of the Chayalei Tzava. And they're allowed to be buried right there where they died. And no one could object. So that's not the takon of Yoshua. Yoshua's takon on behalf of all of Klal Yisrael, of Mes Mitzvah Kodem Makomo, that's a case where there's no one around to bury him. In the case of the later takon on behalf of the Chayalei Tzava, that applies even if there are people around. He's considered like a Mes Mitzvah, even though technically he's not a Mes Mitzvah. There are those who are available, who are obligated to bury him, and they are within close proximity. But nevertheless, they upgraded the status of a chayal such that he's kona makom.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I don't understand what rabbivity is actually adding or subtracting here.
Rav Bibi is trying to tell us that there are very unique or uncommon circumstances in which we suspend the rites of the corpse, which is called Mes Mitzvah Kona Mekomo, and we will move the dead from one place to the other to bury him. Rav Bibi says, what are those unique circumstances? That's when it's called Mutal Al HaMetzar, which means you have a boundary here and a boundary here, and the corpse fills up the width of that boundary from one boundary to the other. And what's wedged down the middle is a Rishus Harab. Yeah.
But why the last thing is he basically saying you can use it whichever side you want? He doesn't seem to be giving the same restrictions as the Baraisa.
Well, I guess he's saying, let me read to you, he says the following,
Bimes, wherever he wants, right?
Right. Bimes ha-mutal ha-metzras, kin klomer medubar bi-ofen she-nimtza ha-mes mutal le-rechov le-rochav kol ha-derech, mi-metzar le-metzar, mi-gvul sada b'stad echol, le-gvul sada b'stad acher, v'ein odom yochol lavar sham, and no one could pass there unless he has direct contact with the dead if we bury it there. Therefore, Chachamim say, Mutalaf lifnoso misham, we can take him away from there. And once we're allowed to take him away, then we can bury him on either side that we want. Now, if we go back to the previous Braisa before Rav Bibi, so the Braisa said, Mifaneo liyamin, Mifaneo lismol. But the Braisa didn't tell us exactly what the circumstances are. You know, the Braisa just says Muto Bisratya. So I think Rav Ashi is coming to clarify what it means, Muto Bisratya. Let me just read to you the note here. He says, Kori l'acherim v'onimo sohainu shim yesh mishi yisasek b'kfuras ames. If we have someone who could bury the dead, and he hears when you call him, Ein ha-kohen rashoy litamilo. The Kohen is not allowed to bury the dead and be metami himself. Of course, there are achirim, and that's called a mitzvah shiyachol lasos al yidei achirim. Now, in the Gemara Nazir, there's machlokas tanoim in a case of a Nazir of a Kohen. So there's a Nazir and a Kohen that are walking together, and they encounter a mes mitzvah. Who of the two of these candidate people, the Kohen Gadol on the one hand, it's not a Kohen Gadol, it's a regular Kohen, right? A Kohen and a Nazir, which of the two should and would be obligated to bury the dead? Muchach, Shekasha Yesh, Odom Echad, Odom Acher, Hayochol Esasek Vimes, Ein HaKohen O HaNazir HaShoyim Litamilo. In other words, if we assume that the Kohen is going to bury the dead, so from the Nazir's perspective, he's not less obligated to bury the dead than the Kohen, but yet the accomplishment of burial can be achieved by someone else, the Kohen, or say it the other way around, by the Nazir. So we see that there's a principle here that if you can get another Ma'acher, someone other than yourself, if let's say you're a Kohen, to bury the dead, then that should, so shall it be. Don't get involved in burying the dead because there's an acher, there's someone else who, without violating any, desecrating any kedusha, he can bury the dead. But then he quotes a yesh mefarsh, shekorei v'achirim onimoso lo nemar le'inyan ha-kohen ha-motzias ha-mes ba-derech elo le'inyan ha-mes atzmo v'hainu she'ilu hoya mes chai. Wow. If we imagine as if he would have been alive and he would call out to others, you know, I'm about to die, please bury me. And others can hear him Ein ze mes mitzvah. She yesh lo krovim shechol mesasik b'kuroso. Aval im ein le mes krovim azai hu b'chlal mes mitzvah. He has no relatives. He's a metz mitzvah. Af im yesh kara noshim she's asku b'kuroso. Wow. This is a whole new interpretation of the Gemara that in a case where he doesn't have any relatives to bury him, then by definition he's a mes mitzvah, even if there are others who can bury him. Again, if it's a kohen, let someone else do it. If there's no one else to do it, the kohen will bury him. And that's even if he has relatives, according to the Yesh Mefarshim. Okay, then we're both sides. So let's just see where we got up to here. And in Mitzvah Hashem, tomorrow we'll make a siyum on the perek. I mean, bring some schnapps. And we're up to upturim mirechitzas yodayim. Okay, then. And that's about, I would say, 12 or maybe 15 lines down from the top at the two dots.